طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with the Palestinian voice of Columbia professor Rashid Khalidi, who appeared on Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now!, this past week, to give a Palestinian perspective to a number of issues in the current news. As we say every week in the opener, such perspective is seldom presented in the U.S. mainstream media, so when it does, we should magnify it. So here is that conversation between Amy Goodman and Rashid Khalidi, discussing several current Palestinian issues in the news.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, has announced she's resigning her post at the end of the year. The former South Carolina governor was one of the few women in Trump's cabinet. She gave no reason for her departure. Haley made the surprise announcement at the White House Tuesday alongside President Trump. During her remarks, she praised the president for pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal and for being a close ally to Israel.
But I'm most excited. Look at the 2 years. Look at what has happened in 2 years with the United States on foreign policy. Now the United States is respected. Countries may not like what we do, but they respect what we do. They know that if we say we're going to do something, we follow it through. And the president proved that, whether it was with the chemical weapons in Syria, whether it's with NATO, saying that other countries have to pay their share. I mean, whether it's the trade deals, which have been amazing, they get that the president means business, and they follow through with that. But then if you look at just these 2 years at the UN, we've cut $1.3 billion in the UN's budget. We've made it stronger. We've made it more efficient. South Sudan, we got an arms embargo, which was a long time coming. Three North Korean sanctions packages, which were the largest in a generation, done in a way that we could really work towards denuclearizing North Korea. The Iran deal, bringing attention to the world that every country needs to understand. You can't overlook all of the bad things they're doing. You have to see them for the threat that they are. I think you look at the anti-Israel bias and the strength and courage that the president showed in moving the embassy and showing the rest of the world, we will put our embassy where we want to put our embassy.
During Nikki Haley's time as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, the United States withdrew from the Paris Climate Accord, the UN Human Rights Council, the Iran nuclear deal, UNRWA, the UN agency that provides humanitarian aid to Palestinians, and UNESCO, the UN Educational and Cultural Agency. The Trump administration also threatened to sanction judges on the International Criminal Court if it went after Israel or the United States for war crimes. And the U.S. refused to sign the Global Compact on Migration, a set of non-binding rules for safe, orderly, and regular migration. While Nikki Haley did not say why she was resigning, she dismissed speculation she'll be running for president in 2020. President Trump says he'll name a replacement in the coming weeks. On Tuesday, he said his daughter Ivanka Trump would be incredible at the job. Ivanka Trump later tweeted that she would not be replacing Haley. The person who does replace her will have to go before a Senate confirmation. Donald Trump also said one possible candidate is Dina Powell, an Egyptian-born Goldman Sachs executive and Trump's former deputy national security advisor. Powell said to be close to the president as well as his daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner. While at the White House, Powell focused in part on U.S. relations with Israel and Saudi Arabia. She attended President Trump's first meeting with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman. NBC reports she was also involved with overseeing a $200 billion arms deal between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. To talk about the significance of Nikki Haley's departure and the role of the United States at the United Nations, we're joined now by Rashid Khalidi, the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, author of several books, his most recent, Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. His next book, titled The 100 Years' War on Palestine, will be out in May. Professor, welcome back to Democracy Now.
Thank you, Amy.
Your first response, was this a shock to you like to so many others?
It was a surprise because she put such a nice face, an articulate face, on a policy that is horrific in many respects, vis-a-vis Palestine, vis-a-vis Iran, on so many fronts. What she was putting forward, while perhaps red meat to the president's base, is probably abhorrent to most Americans and has, contrary to what she said, made the United States much more isolated internationally.
It's also interesting, the timing. She just said, they were saying that they didn't want to look like after the midterm elections, but they say that last week the resignation letter was put in, which was right after Judge Kavanaugh at the time testified and during the FBI supposed investigation. So to say the least, there was a lot of tension within the Trump administration around this. She didn't say anything about this at the time, but of course, if she ran in the future, she could refer back to the period of time that she actually resigned.
Right, and she distanced herself from the president during the campaign by saying any allegations by women should be heard and should be investigated. So she's a very ambitious woman. If she's planning a run, should Trump not run again in 2020 or in 2024, this sets her up perfectly. I mean, it fits perfectly that the ambitious, calculating nature that she's already shown at the UN and in South Carolina.
I wanted to go back to what Nikki Haley said, sitting next to President Trump in the White House, about her relationship with both Trump's daughter, Ivanka, and son-in-law, Jared Kushner. During the news conference, she singled them out for praise.
Jared is such a hidden genius that no one understands. I mean, to redo the NAFTA deal the way he did, what I've done working with him on the Middle East peace plan, it is so unbelievably well done. And Ivanka's been just a great friend, and they do a lot of things behind the scenes that I wish more people knew about, because we're a better country because they're in this administration.
That was Nikki Haley again speaking in the Oval Office next to President Trump, talking about Jared Kushner. This is your expertise. You're a Palestinian-American professor. You're the Edward Said Professor at Columbia University. Talk about Jared Kushner and what she described as his remarkable or incredible role in dealing with the Middle East.
Well, you would only consider it remarkable if you think that denying that the Palestinians have a role, that the Palestinian refugees should return or have any rights, that UNRWA is a good thing, that Jerusalem is a capital and should be a capital for Palestine. The policies that she has put forward and advocated so effectively and articulately are policies that are abhorrent to most of the world, most of the Arab world. Many Israelis realize that this is leading them down the path to a situation where no compromise is possible, where Israel becomes the sole ruler of everything. And Trump seems to be very content with this. The Palestinians should accept whatever place is offered to them in this process. And that is what Kushner has been doing systematically on Jerusalem, on refugees, on the idea of a Palestinian state. They have dismantled all the elements of what I have always considered a very bad American policy has become much worse thanks to her. So Jared Kushner is a genius if you believe that Israel has won and can impose any terms it wants on the Palestinians who should not have sovereignty, self-determination, or statehood. If you believe that, then it's a wonderful policy.
On May 14th, the Israeli military massacred at least 61 unarmed Palestinians, wounded in this one day, 2,700 more, for protesting in Gaza against the Israeli occupation and the opening of the new U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. At the United Nations, U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley blocked a call for an international investigation into Israel's actions.
I asked my colleagues here in the Security Council, who among us would accept this type of activity on your border? No one would. No country in this chamber would act with more restraint than Israel has.
Since March 30th, the beginning of the right of return campaign protests, Israeli soldiers and snipers have killed at least in the area of 195 Palestinians, wounded more than 18,000. Your comments on what she performed at the United Nations?
No country on earth that shot thousands of people on the other side of its border in a situation in which none of its own citizens were hurt. One Israeli soldier actually was killed, but with that exception, would be free of condemnation in the United Nations. Imagine if the United States shot down hundreds of Mexicans, killed 200, and wounded or maimed thousands across the border inside Mexico, in the sovereign territory of another country. It would be completely unacceptable. The Palestinians clearly don't have rights. They can be the victim can be vilified by people like Nikki Haley. It's revolting. The very description of the Palestinians as the aggressors and the Israelis as the victim. Israeli snipers are targeting these people one by one, and the Israelis are being defended by Nikki Haley at the United Nations.
Just before the UN General Assembly denounced Washington's decision to move its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, U.S. Ambassador Haley tweeted a warning to other nations. She wrote, quote, "At the UN, we're always asked to do more and give more. So when we make a decision at the will of the American people about where to locate our embassy, we don't expect those we've helped to target us. On Thursday, there'll be a vote criticizing our choice. The U.S. will be taking names," the ambassador famously said, Professor Hallady.
Yeah, I mean, this is the most vibrant expression of American exceptionalism I've ever heard. The United States is not bound by laws. The United States is not bound by conventions. The United States does exactly as it pleases. The issue of Jerusalem is a complicated legal issue, but it's not that complicated. Everything the United States has done has shredded seven decades, in fact, a little more, of international consensus. As far as the treatment of Jerusalem, and they don't care. The United States under Trump, the United States has always done more or less as it pleased, but at least it paid lip service to law and international legitimacy, not under this administration.
Outgoing U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, has, to say the least, been whatever's happening behind the scenes in lockstep with the administration. She announced in June that the United States was withdrawing from the UN Human Rights Council, accusing the Council of being biased against Israel.
"For too long, the Human Rights Council has been a protector of human rights abusers and a cesspool of political bias. Regrettably, it is now clear that our call for reform was not heeded."
The significance of this?
Well, yet again, the United States is proclaiming that only its views count. The views of the entire world on these issues are simply irrelevant as far as this administration is concerned. The United States has run interference for Israel, protecting it in the United Nations for decades now. And I expect that to continue, irrespective of whether Trump stays on after 2020, unfortunately. But this is the most egregious example of this I've ever seen.
I want to go back to John Bolton, because he's the powerhouse there now. Last month, the National Security Advisor announced the Trump administration would close the Palestine Liberation Organization's mission in Washington in response to a Palestinian effort to push the ICC, the International Criminal Court, to investigate Israel for war crimes. This is Bolton making the announcement in speech at the Federalist Society.
"The Trump administration will not keep the office open when the Palestinians refuse to take steps to start direct and meaningful negotiations with Israel. The United States supports a direct and robust peace process, and we will not allow the ICC or any other organization to constrain Israel's right to self-defense."
So that's John Bolton, not Nikki Haley, but she has supported this, and today is the day?
I believe so.
That the mission is going to be closed in Washington.
Closed today.
And what is the significance of this?
Well, it's once again a diminution of the idea that the Palestinians can speak for themselves, permission to narrate, that they can have a voice in Washington, that they are a party to this conflict. In fact, they're the main party to this conflict. And what the United States and Israel have been doing is to sideline them, weaken them, divide them, and essentially try to dictate terms. And this is part of the whole process that this administration has taken to a new level of knocking out the pillars that had formerly been assumed to be absolutely essential for any approach to peace in Palestine. Refugees, Jerusalem, recognition of Palestinian self-determination.
Let's talk about refugees. The Trump administration said in September would end all U.S. funding for UNRWA, the U.N. agency that provides humanitarian aid to Palestinians. The move was seen as an effort to undermine Palestinians' right to return to the lands they were displaced from by Israeli settlers. This is Chief Palestinian Negotiator Saab Erekat.
So now this is an American political decision added to their decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, move the embassy, consider settlements illegal, refuse the two-state solution 67. So actually this is the program and the agenda of Chilton Adelson and Benjamin Netanyahu. The United States may have the right to say we don't want to give taxpayers money, but who gave the U.S. the right to approve the stealing of my land, my future, my aspiration, my capital, my Aqsa Mosque, my Holy Sepulchre Church? They have no right whatsoever.
The ending of UNRWA funding, I think the U.S. was something like $350 million, but a third for this U.N. agency that helps Palestinians. What does this mean for Palestinians?
Well, it's going to mean further immiseration of a population that in many places like the Gaza Strip are at the point of a humanitarian crisis or are in a humanitarian crisis. But what it is a part of what this unrecognized genius, in Nikki Haley's words, Jared Kushner, is pushing, which is to say there are no Palestinian refugees. This is a false problem created by the Arab states to embarrass Israel, that three generations on they should be forced to stay in the countries to which they were expelled by ethnic cleansing in 1948, and the problem is settled. It's been solved. Israel kicked them out, and they must not ever be allowed to return. So this is, again, kicking out a pillar of a settlement, making, in fact, peace much, much more difficult. If the United States doesn't recognize that there are Palestinian refugees, if it tries to impose on Palestinians in Jordan, for example, that because they have Jordanian nationality, they are therefore Jordanians, not Palestinians, not refugees, then you're denying one of the major issues that's bedeviled the world for 70-odd years.
I want to ask you about Lara Al-Qassam, the 22-year-old student at the University of Florida who's been detained in an Israeli airport for more than a week for supporting a pro-Palestinian boycott campaign. She arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport last week with plans to enroll at an Israeli university and has been held there since while she appeals a deportation order. On Tuesday, the Israeli government told her to apologize and renounce her support for BDS or return to the United States. Professor Halliday, what about Lara?
Well, the thought police are at work here. And this is part of an effort to repress speech in this country, in Europe, in Israel, around this issue, around the issue of Israel's violations of Palestinian rights generally, and specific issues like occupation or refugee return. And the person who's been making the statements in Israel, actually a very important character by the name of Gilad Erdan, who is the Minister of Strategic Affairs, is in fact one of the central people in this worldwide campaign. We see an element of it in turning back people at Ben-Gurion Airport, not just activists, Palestinian-American activists, American Jewish leaders, people who are being detained, harassed, in some cases turned back. Catherine Franke of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And leading law professor at Columbia University.
One of my colleagues at Columbia, precisely. And in this country, the same centralized apparatus is harassing students on campus, bringing lawsuits of absolutely no merit again and again and again, spending hundreds of millions of dollars, it seems to me, on a campaign worldwide in Britain, in Germany, in this country, to essentially shut down discourse on Palestine. You can't talk about that, they're saying.
What needs to happen? And does it matter who is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under President Trump?
It probably matters. But this administration's policies aren't going to change if a less or more articulate representative of nauseating and horrific policies is installed in that seat. I mean, the American government's policies on Iran are causing enormous suffering inside Iran. American policies on Palestine are causing enormous suffering in places like Gaza. Schools will shut down. Children will go without education. Those are awful policies, guided by a sense that the only evil in the Middle East is Iran and its clients and allies, people, for example, like Hamas, who rule the Gaza Strip, ignoring the enormities perpetrated by U.S. allies, like, for example, the Saudi Arabian regime, which is making war on Yemen, creating a humanitarian crisis in Yemen, and at the same time, apparently, liquidating dissidents, prominent dissidents.
That was Rashid Khalani speaking with Amy Goodman on the radio program Democracy Now! And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is a recording of an interview with Israeli historian Ilan Pappe that took place on a program called Community Forum out of Seattle, Washington. It focuses on Pape's latest book, 10 Myths About Israel.
Time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Ilan Pappe. Ilan Pappe is an internationally known historian and author. He was formerly a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Haifa. He is currently a professor with the College of Social Sciences and International Studies at the University of Exeter in the UK. He is the author of numerous books, including Britain and the Arab-Israeli Conflict, The Modern Middle East, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, A History of Modern Palestine, One Land, Two People, and his latest book, 10 Myths About Israel. And he is also speaking this coming Monday evening at Town Hall Seattle. Ilan, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
A pleasure to be here.
So start out, tell us what was your motivation in writing your latest book, 10 Myths About Israel?
The main motivation was to allow people who are either activists or are newcomers to the field of Israel and Palestine to have a kind of an overview of the gap that exists between popular perceptions about Palestine and Israel and the updated research on the question. The basic notion of the book is that the history of the place is an important factor in explaining what goes on today and is also a key for understanding what could be done in the future. And there's a lot of mythology about the history of the place. There's a lot of fabrication, misrepresentation, that is not only intellectually wrong, but politically is undermining the chances for a solution and reconciliation. Now, it's very difficult to ask average activists or people who are interested to read all the recent books and articles that came on Palestine and Israel. There's a huge output on this. So I thought it would be a good idea to take one myth against every myth against the updated research on that myth. So I chose 10 common myths that are prevalent in the public sphere about Israel and Palestine. Shared, this mythology, by the way, is shared by heads of governments, senior politicians, senior academics, and the common person in the street. So there is really a kind of an industry about the history of the place and also the contemporary reality in the place that needs to be challenged, needs to be encountered with truth, with facts, not just with emotions and beliefs. And that was the idea, to do it as in a concise manner as possible, almost like a pocketbook that people could have, because there's a lot of ignorance and misunderstanding about Israel and Palestine. And again, I stress the point, this is not only wrong because the facts are wrong. I really strongly believe that this misunderstanding does not allow us there in Israel and Palestine to progress towards peace and reconciliation.
And weren't you born in Israel?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And you served in the IDF?
I did.
So, and I ask because they're discussing this topic for those of us who didn't grow up in Israel and or who are not Jewish, can make one extremely uncomfortable with the subject matter. And one of those words and terms that is used a lot these days is Zionism. And I was hoping you would define that for us, because, again, that's a word that immediately at least used to make me want to just, you know, run away from even discussing the topic.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. This is a sensitive, charged topic. In the book, there are two myths out of the ten that relate to Zionism. The first myth is that Zionism is only a national liberation movement of the Jews, and I will come back to it in a moment. And the other one is that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. So these are two chapters out of the 10 chapters of the book. So let me say something about the first one. It is important to know the history of Zionism, and it started as a movement of Jews in Europe who rightly felt insecure in Europe and were looking for a way to save themselves and the other Jews, and they had the foresight, one should say. They started thinking about it in the late 19th century, and 70 years after that, the Holocaust happened, so they had the right impulse to leave Europe, because Europe did not want, at least in certain parts of Europe, Jews really were under existential danger. The second reason that Zionism emerged was that, like many other cultural and religious groups in Europe, this was the age of nationalism, or what we call the spring of nations, when a lot of groups felt more comfortable to redefine their religious identity as a national identity. It felt more modern. It felt more secular. And so Jews, and they were not the only ones, a lot of other groups underwent such a process. So Zionism was at first a movement of people trying to get out of Europe and redefine Judaism as a nation state, and there was nothing wrong with it. The problem is that for religious reasons mainly, and because of a lot of pressure from Christian Zionists who were already active then, Palestine was chosen as a destination, or the place where these two impulses can be met, you know, the search for security and the wish to be redefined as a nation. As happened often with such projects in the past, the places you chose already had someone living there for centuries. Now, most of these movements, and Zionism included, and that's very unfortunate, decided that the only way they can implement the wish to be safe and to be a nation was by uprooting the native population. Your listeners should be familiar with American history. There's a similar chapter here with the way the white settlers genocided the Native Americans. It's not different. We call, in the scholarly world, we call these movements settler colonialism. We distinguish between them and colonialism, because the settler colonialists are intent on destroying and eliminating the natives. And I think that's what happened in Palestine. So Zionism became, from a movement of liberation, a movement that dispossessed the local native Palestinians. And its very existence is an existential threat to the Palestinians, has been from the very beginning and still is today. So it is important, as my book tries to show, to know the history of Zionism and to differentiate what was positive about this ideology and what is negative. And from the Palestinian perspective, this is really bad news throughout the history. The second point I was making in the book is about anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And I tell the story of the general Jewish perception of Zionism. When it started, a lot of Jews did not accept it, either because they were very religious and they thought that the idea of returning to a holy land without a religious imperative was meddling with God's ways. Most of the liberal Jews created the Reform Movement and regarded this country as a far better destination for saving Jews and making them a modern community, which was at least as successful as the Zionist project, one should say. The American Jewish experience was not a bad one. If anything, it was a very positive one. So there were alternatives to Zionism, even if the problem that Zionism pointed to, the existential danger in Europe, was the right one. It was not the only way of doing it. And even after the Holocaust and after the creation of the State of Israel, Israel is not the safest place for Jews. In fact, the United States is far, far safer for Jews. More than 25,000 Jews died in Israel since the creation of the state, so you can't say this is the safest place for Jews. Jewish communities around the world are much safer. You don't have to subscribe to the idea that to be a Jew you need to colonize Palestine or dispossess the Palestinians, and therefore you can have a legitimate argument against Zionist ideology as a Jew, even in my case as an Israeli Jew. I'm not a self-hating Jew, I'm not a self-hating anti-Semite, and none of you are anti-Semites if you think that Zionism has a very strong colonialist ideology in it, which is not fitting and inappropriate for the 21st century. And challenging it is very much like challenging apartheid in South Africa. And people were not called anti-Christian because they challenged apartheid. And we are not anti-Islamic if we don't accept Al-Qaeda's ideology. So we need to know the facts, and then people can have a proper discussion with us. But I'm afraid that people are throwing the anti-Semitic accusation in order to stifle the necessary debate about the future of Israel and Palestine.
It seems that is also used with some people who criticize Israel itself and the government of Israel, that they are labeled as being anti-Semitic. What is your thoughts on that?
Yes, that's even more ridiculous in a way. I mean, I can understand at least people's uneasiness when I talk about the ideology of the state. That I really think that the ideology of the state, at least to me, is unacceptable on a moral basis, also on a political, from a political perspective. But it's even more pathetic, I think, and ridiculous to accuse people who criticize a policy of a state as being against a religion. It's almost like people in the United States who would have an issue with an American policy, domestic or foreign, it doesn't matter, and would be regarded as anti-Christian. In fact, what I think the book shows, at least tries to show, and I hope it comes across quite clearly for those who read it, is that a lot of issues which would be very sensical and a commonsensical, if you want, in other cases do not work in the case of Israel. So it is very normal to criticize policies of governments around the world without being silenced of being a racist. Only in the case of Israel, if you criticize Israeli policy, it means that you are anti-Semitic. It's a ridiculous accusation, and it is being used because Israel has lost the moral argument. Israel has no moral justification for what it is doing to the Palestinians and what it had done to the Palestinians. And when your moral justification is shaky, you are becoming aggressive. We know it from our human behavior. I mean, it's not just nations that behave in such a way. Human beings behave such a way. And I think it's time to be less timid and not to be, you know, afraid because of these kinds of tactics. In fact, it's for the benefits of the Jews in Israel as well if Americans will tell them you have repugnant policies on the ground that either you identify with or you're not willing to challenge. And therefore, I'm a great supporter of the idea of boycotting official Israel as long as it continues its aggressive and oppressive policies towards the Palestinians.
Did I read correctly that one of your motivations in no longer teaching at the University of Haifa was related to your support of the BDS movement?
Not only. The BDS movement started in 2005. I was already targeted by the university in 2000, so I have a long history of being a dissenting voice. I think that the university could not tolerate someone whose profession is history. So, I mean, Israel had dissident academics before me, but they were teaching other topics. So it seems like this is their what they're doing in the free time, but they're not doing it in the classroom because they're teaching chemistry or, you know, or architecture. I think I was one of the first to destined to teach history and history of Israel, but I decided to do it from a different perspective, from the mainstream ideological kind of point of view, and they just couldn't tolerate it. So, you know, when they started the proceeding against me in 2006, eventually, their kind of indictment was 10 pages long. So I was guilty of many, many things. All of them have to do with not being loyal to the hegemonic ideology of the state. I mean, that was the bottom line. You cannot teach the history of Zionism as an anti-Zionist. That was their main conclusion. So I had to leave.
So it wasn't because your classes weren't filling up and you weren't...
Oh, no. It was actually quite ridiculous. On the year they decided to get rid of me, I was chosen by the students of the university as the best lecturer. So the guy who chucked me out had to give me the award for being the best lecturer. So that was his last... That was my last official capacity, was getting recognition from the university of being the best lecturer in Haifa. And yet the one who had to leave. That was a really a funny moment, I should say, yes.
So you mentioned previously that Israel was set up similar to the U.S. as a settler colonialism. Is settler colonialism still the mandate in Israel currently?
I think so, and I think that's what's so unique about Israel. I mean, the United States was built on this idea, you know, Europeans running away from Europe, encountering the native population happened in South Africa, South America, Australia, New Zealand. But in all these countries, these are the projects of the past. Probably the most recent one we have is South Africa, and the settler colonialist project there was dismantled in the late 1980s. So Israel is the only active settler colonialist project, a state project that still works. And there may be some other cases like the Polisario, the Saharan desert people and their struggle against the Moroccan government. But this is the main active one. And it's part of the state ideology. It's part of the state's educational system. It's part of the perception. Settler colonialism, unfortunately, is not only about removing the native as much as you can or taking a very superior attitude towards the native, has happened in South Africa through apartheid. There is unfortunately also a kind of dehumanization of the native, of the local. And my educational struggle in Israel is really to humanize the Palestinians in the eyes of the Israelis, which is not an easy project. The whole educational system is built on the dehumanization of the Palestinians. So even liberal Israelis are Israelis who regard the Palestinians as aliens, but they are tolerant enough to let them be there or have some of the land. There's a basic misunderstanding, even the more liberal Zionists, that Zionism emigrated into the homeland of someone else, not that these natives emigrated. They are not immigrants. Not that we should treat immigrants in any bad way. Of course, we shouldn't. But it's funny that the whole liberal discourse in Israel about the Palestinians is the discourse of immigrants. So if you are a liberal person, you tolerate immigrants. You're willing to let them be absorbed into the society. But this is not the situation. These are not immigrants. You are the immigrants. And you have to ask the Palestinians to allow you to stay. And this is something very difficult. After 100 years of oppression, to understand that the oppressor needs the legitimacy from the oppressed is very difficult to accept. I think also the Palestinians suddenly realized that this is their mission. It took them a long the Palestinian National Movement for too many years was depicting the Zionist movement as a classical colonialist movement. By this I mean that they thought they had the ability to drive these people back to their homeland, but they had no homeland. So the Palestinians, I think, very cleverly in the last 20, 30 years understood that their mission is not to think of how to get rid of the Jews in Israel, but how to tell them that they are welcome, but it has to be within a political system that grants equality to everyone, not the kind of apartheid system that we have today in Israel.
Well, then that kind of jumps to one of the points in your new book, 10 Myths About Israel, that Israel is currently portrayed in corporate media as the only democracy in the Middle East. Is that true?
No. I think it's one of the biggest fabrication is to call Israel a democracy. I always tell my students, I did in Haifa, as I do in the UK, if you take any general book you have in political science of what defines a democracy, Israel doesn't pass the test on every aspect. Israel was not a democracy until 1967 because it put one-fifth of its citizens under military rule. Military rule means that citizens don't have any basic human rights and civil rights. This is the Palestinian minority. So definitely, if one-fifth of the American population would have been under military rule, namely that only a military person would determine your basic rights, you wouldn't have called the United States a democracy. And after 1967, they have occupied another group of Palestinians, millions of them, and denied them even in a harsher way any basic right. At least the first Palestinian group was allowed to vote and to be elected. The new Palestinian group that Israel incorporated doesn't even have the right to vote or to be elected. They have no say in their own fate. The same military regulation that Israel used against the Palestinian community before 67 are now used against the Palestinian community in the West Bank. So in many ways, Israel reminds me of South Africa because whites in South Africa enjoyed a certain level of democracy, but the Africans did not enjoy any level of democracy. And the same is true about Israel. So you can say that for the Jews in Israel, Israel is a democracy, but anyone who is not a Jew is a second-rate, if not a third-rate, citizen. And there are legal discrimination against the Palestinians, whether they are citizens of Israel or they live in the occupied territories. That is official apartheid. There are practices which are not officially admitted but are very known to everyone that discriminate against you. I will just give you one fact which I think is very important, and I think most of your listeners probably don't know. I'm talking now about Israel within the pre-1967 borders, so to make it clear. According to the Israeli law, most of the land of Israel belongs to the Jewish Agency. According to the charter of the Jewish Agency, it is not allowed to sell land to non-Jews. So 97% of the land of Israel is not for sale to the Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are 20% of the population. So they have no access to buying land, to purchase land, to expand. In fact, in the last 70 years, only Jewish settlements and Jewish towns have been built, not one Palestinian citizen. Another example, we have a law in Israel which allows a Jewish community to reject the presence of a Palestinian citizen, I'm talking about citizens, in their midst, because they are the only reason that they are Palestinians, that they are not Jewish. Imagine if there would be a neighborhood in Seattle that could be, by law, decided African Americans could not live there. I'm talking about official racism. I'm not talking about informal racism that definitely exists in every society. I don't think Israel is unique in that. But I think it's quite unique for a country that pertains to be the only democracy in the Middle East to have laws that discriminate against people just because of their identity. That, for me, is the definition of a non-democratic society.
Actually, Seattle used to have redlining, which prevented people of color, blacks, from purchasing property in major portions of the city.
Absolutely, and that was a dark chapter in the history of the United States. It still goes on in Israel in 2017.
So the settlements continue as of today, isn't that correct?
Absolutely. I write about it in one of the last myths that I describe in the book, that there is kind of a myth that there are two different political camps in Israel, a peace camp that wants to believes in a two-state solution and wants to get out of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and hand it over to the Palestinians, and the kind of war camp, the right wing, that is opposed to any settlement with the Palestinians. Well, actually, most of the settlement activity was done under the so-called peace camp, when a peace camp was in government. Colonizing Palestine, whether before 1948 under British rule or until 1967 within the pre-67 borders of Israel or after 1967 in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, is a Zionist project that everybody in the Zionist parties believe in. They have tactical discussion where to settle. The right wing wants to settle even in densely populated Arab areas in the West Bank because they believe that these are the biblical sites. The left wing, so-called left wing in Israel, believes that it's not necessary to settle where Palestinians live, so you settle anywhere else in the West Bank, which made the whole idea of a two-state solution unviable, non-viable. Settlements continue because most of the Israelis believe in them, and because the government throughout the history of the occupation since 1967 very cleverly divided in the perception of people the West Bank into two areas. There is the Jewish West Bank, where everybody agrees you can settle, and supposedly even the international community doesn't mind if you settle there. And there is the Palestinian West Bank, which is sort of 40% of the West Bank, which is densely populated by Palestinians, that if you are a reasonable Israeli, you don't think it's necessary to settle there. Even you don't mind if these areas would be called the Palestinian state. I noted a similar, in a book I wrote a year ago, which compared South Africa to Israel, I noted there was a similar view among liberal apartheid people, so to speak, in South Africa, who thought that the Bantustans, the idea that the Africans would have their independent, autonomous kingdoms, would enable the whites to sustain the apartheid system forever. So I think settlements have to be understood as a consensual Zionist project from the very beginning because of the settler colonialist nature of the state and the movement that created the state.
So just a few minutes left. So do you believe you support a one-state solution, and do you see a reasonable compromise that can be met in your lifetime?
Yes. Well, first of all, I think that one has to realize the imbalance between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The Israelis have the strongest army in the Middle East. They are probably the most powerful state in the Middle East, in the region, and probably beyond. The Palestinians are the weakest political group in the area. And so the first thing I believe, even before one-state solution, and I devote my life to this, is to convince the international community that it's in the interest of the international community to put pressure on Israel to, first of all, change its immediate policies of oppression, even before we talk about a solution, in order to create conducive circumstances for a solution. We need to get the Israelis out of the life of the Palestinians in the West Bank, to lift the siege over the Gaza Strip, to stop the discrimination against the Palestinians in Israel, and to seriously consider the right of the Palestinian refugees to return. Now, if I take all these three basic rights that Israel violates, the rights to live in peace in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, in a democracy inside Israel, and to come back home for the refugees, I can only see one political outfit that would enable us to implement these rights, and that's one democratic state for all. Because I think otherwise any other political solution would perpetuate it, would make it even worse than it is today. And when I say worse, it's mainly worse for the Palestinians, but I also think it's not a very positive for the Jews. So the sake for everyone, we should live democratically, as you do here in the United States, as human beings, regardless of our identity, religious identity, national identity, gender or color.
So one person, one vote?
One person, one vote. I'm willing to take a binational state if that is what people want. It's much better than what we have today. Maybe people would want the collective identity. I can appreciate it, especially on the Jewish side, because they have built a culture of their own. I think a lot of Palestinians would go along with this, but the state has to be a state for everyone and should not be divided, should not be partitioned. And the third generation of settlers and the native people have a very good chance of making Palestine and Israel and whatever we'll call it one of the best places on earth.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was a conversation with Ilan Pappe on the radio program Community Forum out of Seattle. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive, to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.